This is the BBC.
Hello, and welcome to The Boring Talks. This is a podcast where we have a series of speakers who talk about subjects that may appear boring to others, but that they find very interesting. And who knows, maybe you will too. My name is James Ward, and I'm the host of this podcast. In this episode of The Boring Talks, we hear from Dr. Eleanor Herring. Eleanor is a lecturer in design history and theory at the Glasgow School of Art. She'll be asking the question, lampposts, are you for or against?
Hi, my name's Ellie. I'm a design historian, and much of my research is driven by a fascination with why things look the way they do and who gets to decide. For quite a few years now, I've been fascinated with street furniture design. I even wrote a book about it. For those of you who aren't familiar with what that term means, street furniture is a type of freestanding urban object. And I don't mean the old sofas, televisions and abandoned fridges that line the street where I live, though technically they are street furniture. I mean benches, bollards, bins, bus shelters, postboxes, poles, posts and parking meters. Things that are deliberately placed in the street to perform some kind of function, or even several functions simultaneously. Now, shortly after I started my investigation into street furniture, I was at a hen party for my friend Alex, and I got talking to her mum, Pat. Pat very politely listened to me ramble on about bollards, and then she asked me a question. Are you for or against lampposts? At the time, it struck me as a funny question. I'd never known there was a debate about something as boring as lampposts. But as I continued reading about street furniture, it occurred to me that Pat's question wasn't so strange after all. Throughout history, people have held really strong views about lampposts. As early as 1880, a man called John T. Emmett wrote an essay for the British Quarterly Review about the lamps in Trafalgar Square in London, which he described as absurd contrivances. The following year, he extended his criticism to the lamps on Euston Road. This seeming galaxy, he said, was all a sham and wholly useless save as an expensive daylight show. The arrival of electric light prompted further complaints. For some, the lampposts themselves were eyesores, largely because of their technical appearance, while for others, it was the quality of light the lamps emitted that was the problem. In 1895, novelist Robert Louis Stevenson argued in his Plea for Gas Lamps that electric light should only shine on murders and public crime or along the corridors of lunatic asylums, a horror to heighten horror. It was, he said, horrible, unearthly, obnoxious to the human eye, a lamp for a nightmare. The architect, designer and writer William Morris shared Stevenson's anxiety. He argued that an illuminated society was not just undesirable, but also vulgar and disturbing. The reasons why these people resisted lighting the city was complicated. For the historian Chris Otter, a city from which darkness has been expunged to allow general omniscience was a city devoid of that most cherished value, personal privacy, or the ability to altogether escape from the gaze of others. Indeed, there is a long history of objections to street lamps, which is often linked to the use of light as a means of controlling space and the behaviour of those who use it. But it was in Britain after the Second World War that the lamppost provoked some of the strongest feelings. During this time, the process by which the street was shaped, and importantly, who had the power to shape it, was closely linked to the state. As part of the British government's effort to rebuild the social order and improve standards after the war, considerable attempts were made to modernise the country. New town developments and expanding road infrastructure, as well as deliberate campaigns to educate the public on good modern design, meant that street furniture emerged as a key element of post-war reconstruction. Ensuring that objects as ubiquitous as lampposts looked modern was vitally important because it gave Britain's social and cultural agenda physical expression and introduced good design into the street. But what exactly was a modern lamppost? And what did it look like? For the design community, a modern lamppost was a sleek, undecorated steel affair with graceful curves and electric light. It was, its supporters claimed, unobtrusive and able to fit in anywhere. For some of these people, the end of the Blitz presented an incredible opportunity for renewal. Suddenly, they were presented with a blank slate upon which new street furniture could be placed. Whole new ways of living could be imagined. Britain could finally join the modern world. The reality, however, was somewhat different because many of the decisions for lampposts were made in local government committee meetings, where the public had no say and those present had little, if any, design or aesthetic training. For the borough engineers and surveyors working at local authorities, a modern lamppost meant cheap concrete cast in any number of different shapes. Some were tall, some were short, some were thick, some were thin, some were shaped like inverted question marks, some had a starburst detail around the column. Some lucky places, like Hackney and Morecambe, even had lampposts shaped like elongated swans, their necks outstretched and an electric lantern clasped between their beaks. But they were all made from buff-coloured concrete, the colour of burnt porridge. Now, problems began when people started to notice these lampposts during the day, and many of them didn't like what they were seeing. One of the earliest critics was the writer and poet John Betjeman, who emerged as a sort of figurehead for the protection of local architectural and cultural heritage in the 1950s. In a letter to the Times in August 1950, headlined Ugly Lampposts, Betjeman criticised the craze for functionalist modern lampposts and described them as gibbets, frightful and clumsy. The columns, he said, were too thick, the colour and texture too drab, and they were painfully out of place and usually out of scale with their surroundings. Due to the level of interest in Betjeman's letter, the Times responded a few days later with an editorial observing that lampposts have possibly affected the life of ordinary people much more than they commonly realise. The chief need is for better educated taste among matters of lampposts, as well as in local authorities who have the choosing of them. For Betjeman, and others like him, local government was to blame for causing this damage to the urban environment, and he was often invited to participate in local campaigns against modern lampposts. Following one such invitation from a resident of Lyme Regis about the town's beastly new lampposts, Betjeman warned her that town clerks are all standard men, and so are the pettifogging borough surveyors who erect these concrete lamp standards. You have been subjected to the usual tyranny. In fact, this word tyranny comes up a lot and seems to characterise the whole debate. People across the country really did feel that they were being subjected to the tyranny of other people's taste, or lack of it, in lampposts. But it wasn't just well-known cultural figures and members of the architectural and design community who railed against these terrible posts. Members of the public also got involved. One early confrontation took place in London's Highgate district in 1953, following a letter of complaint from Lady Nora Ritson to the borough engineer at St Pancras Council, Mr Bainbridge. The complaint concerned the new lighting scheme outside Ritson's home in Highgate Village. According to Lady Ritson, the introduction of concrete neon lighting standards had no place in one of the oldest and most unspoiled parts of London. And she added that the standards were needlessly grotesque, the design is poor, the colour ugly, and the light they throw is atrocious, making every human face seem subhuman. This is a grave defect and against public policy in a village place frequented by courting couples. Lady Ritson's objection to the colouring of lighting and its negative effect on the pallor of pedestrians, particularly courting couples, was in fact a common complaint. Just imagine the potential consequences for the nation's birth rate. In fact, different criteria for judging lampposts might explain why disputes became so heated. Many on the municipal side believed that specialist daylight committees only cared about the appearance of columns during the daylight hours, that and nothing else. For some local councils, street lighting was intended to pierce the gloom and to make British people and cities gay, exciting and glamorous. Others paid careful attention to the effect on lipstick. In 1958, Norwich City Council was reported to have considered the effect of different types of street lighting on women's makeup before choosing their new installation. As one delegate at a 1961 municipal lighting conference explained, the pedestrian had usually completed a heavy day at work and was entitled to consideration in walking out with a companion whose features and dress should be seen in reasonable or even complementary colour rendering. She should not appear to be dressed in drab material and having yellow or colourless features. Some of the complaints about lampposts were more paranoid. The Municipal Journal questioned the substance to some complaints, citing one example where a man complained about a streetlight's effect on his prize-winning chrysanthemums, and another where a woman suspected the light of providing those with evil intent to spy on her. In 1955, the Architectural Review published a campaign called Outrage, which sought to alert its readership to offences against the British landscape. A chief offender was the modern lamppost. Outrage was, the architect Hugh Casson observed, a tourist guide in reverse, picking out the bad and not the good. And the guide identified several specific sites that were particularly poor. Boers Hill in Oxford was considered typical of the problem, having framed its skyline between concrete lamp standards. Leamington had shown some ingenuity in the careful choice of the wrong lamp standards for the wrong place, and Warwick's lamp standards had a bad case of elephantiasis. Campaigns like Outrage must have touched a nerve, because as the 1950s went on, more and more members of the public took action against modern lampposts. Some people wrote letters to their local council, but others adopted a much more confrontational approach. In 1956, the sculptor Arnold Machen asked his wife to padlock him to a Victorian gas lamp on The Villas, his Victorian estate in Stoke-on-Trent, as part of his attempt to resist its removal by the local authority. As reported in the Daily Mail, while workmen hired to fit the electric replacements looked on, Machen and his wife defied Subtopia by reading The Seven Lamps of Architecture by John Ruskin while shielding themselves from the sun with an umbrella. The police eventually arrived, and despite Machen's status as a Royal Academy member, his bid to protect the lamp failed and the new lamps were finally installed. Nonetheless, a compromise was reached. The gas lamp in question was reinstalled in Machen's garden. According to Machen's nephew, the irony is that The Villas was declared a conservation zone some years later, and the modern concrete lampposts were all replaced with replica cast iron lamps. other protests also made the papers. In an article titled "Do Britain's Lampposts Drive You Mad?", published in Everybody's Weekly in 1957, establishment figure Professor Albert E. Richardson was pictured shaking his umbrella at a particularly objectionable example outside his 18th century home in Bedfordshire. He was quoted as saying, "Don't call them streetlights, call them monstrosities." As a man who reputedly read only 18th century newspapers and who deliberately rejected electricity in his Georgian home, it is arguable that Richardson would have railed against modernisation of any kind. Despite his efforts, Richardson's protest was unsuccessful and the modern lamps were installed. A plaque was subsequently commissioned commemorating that "these incongruous lampposts, which detract from the beauty of this historic town, were erected by the Urban District Council against the advice of the Royal Fine Art Commission." Many people in the 1950s and 60s felt that ornamental historic lampposts were worth keeping, and eventually this was a view that even local councils began to support. In 1959, Old Bosham Parish Council rejected its own modern street lighting installation for being too ugly. And when Chipping Camden erected a pilot scheme of electric street lamps in 1960 and asked residents to vote on their preference, they voted overwhelmingly in favour of gas lamps. Clearly, the design of lampposts was considered to be vitally important by almost everyone involved. The debate wasn't only shaped by what these objects looked like, but by questions about the taste of those responsible, their social position in society, and ultimately their authority to make design decisions on behalf of a nation. And I think those questions are far from boring. But to return to Pat's question, personally, I'm for lampposts, since I like to see where I'm going in the dark. Whereas, as a countryside dweller, Pat was against them since they spoiled the night sky. So, are you for or against lampposts?
Thank you, Ellie. Personally, I'm still undecided on lampposts. That's all from The Boring Talks for this week. It was presented by me, James Ward, and the producer was Luke Doran. If you're enjoying these podcasts, then why not leave a review with your podcast provider? Or better still, tell a friend. One day they may even forgive you. On next week's Boring Talk, we'll be hearing from a man who counts his sneezes.